Hello, this is On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Andrew Prince. This week, we'll hear about a mysterious decline in striped bass, a tale of two farmers, one who farms organic sugar beets and one who farms a genetically engineered kind. A group of researchers ask, did climate change cause the fall of the Roman Empire? And there's some early new evidence that humans may have left Africa earlier than previously thought. But first, we take a look back at an American tragedy. 25 years ago, about a minute after liftoff, the Space Shuttle Challenger blew apart, killing all aboard, including teacher astronaut Krista McAuliffe. NPR's Joe Palca has this report on how the Challenger accident affected this country and how it may have affected American attitudes towards science.
On January 28, 1986, President Ronald Reagan was scheduled to deliver his State of the Union speech, but Challenger changed those plans.
Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country. This is truly a national loss.
President Reagan expressed in words what many people were feeling that day.
It was a huge shock to the American people because the space shuttle had come to represent our entire technological prowess.
That's Senator Bill Nelson from Florida. At the time, he was Congressman Bill Nelson. He was also astronaut Bill Nelson. His mission aboard the space shuttle Columbia had ended just 10 days earlier. Nelson says it was shocking enough just to think about what happened to Challenger.
And when people suddenly saw on their television screens that was played over and over the close-up shot of those solid rocket boosters going off in different directions about 10 miles high in the Florida sky, I mean, this was a trauma to the nation's psyche.
The country had to revisit that trauma 17 years later.
This day has brought terrible news and great sadness to our country.
The day was February 1st, 2003. This time it was President George W. Bush trying to help the country deal with tragedy in space.
At 9 o'clock this morning, Mission Control in Houston lost contact with our space shuttle Columbia.
There were no iconic pictures from the Columbia accident. It was just a vapor trail streaking across the sky and some close-ups of bits of debris. But shocking as it was, the second loss of a space shuttle didn't hit the country in the gut the way the first one did. John Miller thinks he knows the reason for that. Miller is at the University of Michigan, where he studies public attitudes toward science.
The first time it blew up, it was such a shock because most people thought it would never, ever happen. But once you get the idea that spacecraft sometimes have catastrophic events, then it becomes less of a shock.
That's why the Challenger destruction seemed to affect day-to-day Americans a lot more than did Columbia years later.
Senator Nelson says the arrogance of NASA managers and their inattentiveness to legitimate safety was in part responsible for both accidents, problems he believes the agency no longer suffers from. Bruce Lewenstein thinks the long-term impact of Challenger may be in how it changed the way Americans view science. Lewenstein is a professor of science communication at Cornell University. He says NASA had always been the good news agency, freely sharing science news with journalists. But after Challenger, everyone at the agency clammed up, including scientists.
People had this image that science didn't operate that way. But in fact, modern science, big science, does operate that way. And Challenger was one of the ways we discovered that, and perhaps one of the most dramatic ways we discovered that.
Lewenstein says journalists and the public came to understand that big science behaved like other big institutions, sometimes making mistakes and sometimes hiding the truth. Lewenstein says there was a positive legacy for NASA from the Challenger accident. When the Columbia accident occurred, the space agency certainly seemed to be more open about what was going on, a good move from a public relations perspective.
They were more open with information. They were more careful to try to get different perspectives out there. They were more careful to try to make information available.
Later this year, the space shuttle fleet is to be retired permanently. NASA takes pains to remind people that space is still a dangerous place. No doubt the agency is doing all it can to make sure President Obama doesn't have to make the same kind of speech his predecessors did before the shuttle program comes to an end. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Our ancestors, the first modern humans, evolved in Africa about 200,000 years ago. When and how they eventually left Africa and fanned across the globe is a part of our history that's still up for debate. Some newly discovered stone tools now suggest that our ancestors might have left the continent much earlier and by a different route than scientists previously thought. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
The tools are primitive hand axes and scrapers made of stone. They were dug up next to a rocky desert mountain in the United Arab Emirates by the Persian Gulf. And they're ancient, 100,000 to 125,000 years old. What's more, they look very similar to the tools made by the early humans living in East Africa around that time. The startling implication is that these humans may have left Africa by heading right across the Arabian Peninsula.
I think the interpretation of the site is probably going to be fairly contentious.
Simon Armitage works at the University of London and was part of the research team.
What it does is push back by quite a lot the time frame in which we think anatomically modern humans, so you and me, migrated out of Africa, where we'd evolved, and subsequently began to populate the rest of the world.
Scientists have generally thought that modern humans departed from Africa around 60,000 years ago by moving northward along the Nile and then the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. But Armitage and his colleagues now think our ancestors may have set out tens of thousands of years earlier, when unusual climate conditions would have opened up a different route. Back then, the strait at the southern end of the Red Sea would have been drier and more narrow than it is today. Humans could have made an easy crossing to a place that would have looked very different from today's deserts.
The southern end of the Arabian Peninsula was actually quite wet, so it was a kind of savanna-type landscape. And that's reasonably conducive to human habitation.
From there, humans could have moved on to Asia and beyond. Researchers say the new report in the journal Science is provocative, but cautioned against making too many assumptions based on just one archaeological find. Allison Brooks is an archaeologist at George Washington University.
I think that the comparisons to Africa from a few stone tools are always basically just a hypothesis. And we need more work and more stone tools to really cement that connection.
Brooks points out that no fossilized bones were found to show who really made these tools. The discovery site is outside the range of the Neanderthals, but there's no way to know what the toolmakers looked like and whether they really were our ancestors who had left Africa or some other group that independently invented the same techniques.
Certainly, it's a very intriguing find. And it should hopefully spur research in all kinds of places and directions that haven't been undertaken before.
Researchers say that's already started to happen. Tony Marks is an archaeologist with Southern Methodist University in Dallas who analyzed the tools. He says in the past, archaeologists believed that the windswept deserts of this region weren't such a great place to find artifacts buried in a way that preserved their history.
So the fact that this material was actually in the ground, undisturbed, was really exceptional.
He predicts that as more expeditions get underway, they'll make more discoveries like this one. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Along the East Coast, striped bass is among the most coveted of fish. They're big and full-bodied with dark stripes along their sides, and they're delicious. During the 1980s, stripers were in deep trouble. Wildlife managers said they were overfished and laid down severe catch limits. The population recovered, and fishing resumed in what is considered one of conservation's greatest success stories. But now catches are down again. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some biologists say the problem isn't overfishing this time. It's the weather.
Brad Burns started fishing for striped bass in 1960. Last week, I caught him by phone as he was running a booth for his group, Stripers Forever, at a fly fishing show in New Jersey. He says his members have been singing the blues about stripers.
What we hear from people that go striped bass fishing, the general trend very decidedly is down.
Stripers live in the ocean as well as in estuaries and some rivers. Burns says members have been reporting fewer fish for the past 5 years. As for the cause...
Well, I don't know, and I don't know that anybody does.
But Bob Wood thinks he might. Wood's a biologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He studies his fish in a boxy little building on the Maryland shore of the Chesapeake Bay.
So come on in. And what we have here is a way to run controlled experiments on nutrition and disease.
Here, scientists keep vats full of striped bass and white perch, two species that spawn in the bay. This is where Wood's team tries to figure out why striper numbers go up and go down. They thought they had the 1980s crash figured out.
The striped bass crashed because of overfishing, and then it recovered because we closed the fishery.
But now Wood has a new idea that's just taking shape.
This research, at first glance, seems to call that into question. But it's not that easy.
This novel idea focuses not so much on fish, but on the weather, and especially the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, or the AMO. The AMO is a mashup of wind and ocean currents, a flip-flop that happens every 35 years or so in the North Atlantic.
Circulation changes in a way that warms the entire basin. And you can imagine if you warm the entire North Atlantic basin, you're changing the weather because the air and the circulation patterns above the ocean are then affected.
Ed Martino is a fisheries scientist who works with Wood at NOAA. He says when that AMO shift happens, it affects the local weather along the Atlantic coast.
You're talking about differences in temperature or precipitation and therefore river flow or salinity, ultimately all affecting the base of the food chain. It's the way that the climate affects the microscopic plankton.
Plankton, little tiny plants and animals in the water. That's what young stripers eat. Here's how they think the AMO is messing with fish food. When it's in a warm phase, springtime along the East Coast actually tends to be wet and cool. More rain, more water, more food. In the years following that phase, striper numbers tend to go up. Then the AMO flips. Drier springs, less rain, less food. After a lag, it looks like striper numbers start to decline. Wood says the past 100 years of fishing records show that very trend, which brings us to the present crash in stripers.
It hasn't been so good in the last, say, 5 years. And it just so happens this is also the time where the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation seems to be switching phase.
Into a bad-for-stripers phase. Wood suspects it was also a down cycle that caused the striper crash in the 1980s. When that cycle ended, stripers recovered, not just due to the fishing limits, but because the fish liked the weather better. Janet Nye studies fish stocks for the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. She thinks this research could help fisheries managers.
We would be able to say, okay, for the next 35 years or so, we're pretty certain that the AMO is going to be more positive or warm. And we'd be able to say, these are the fish that respond favorably to that. You might be able to fish those more.
Or in a down cycle, says Bob Wood, fish less.
If we know that there is this cycle coming up, a trend that we are beginning to enter, we can keep that in our heads as we set limits.
If Wood's research is correct, it may take tougher catch limits to bring striper numbers back up again. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Peaceful coexistence. It's a Cold War phrase, but now it's being used in agriculture. These days, there is increasing tension between those who grow crops organically and those who grow genetically modified plants. NPR's Dan Charles brings us the story of two farmers whose lush valley might not be big enough for the two of them.
You can grow almost anything in the valley along the Willamette River in western Oregon. The soil is rich and the weather is mild. Settlers who came here on the Oregon Trail once called this place Eden. With the luxury of choice, many farmers here grow seed. Seed for cabbage, spinach, Swiss chard, beets, and grass. Their harvest goes all over the world, the U.S., Europe, and Asia. One of those farmers is Tim Wynn, who's lived on the same farm his whole life.
I try to be considerate of my neighbors, and I think that would extend right clear up into my farming.
Another is Frank Morton, who moved to Oregon to go to college.
I probably intended to be an artist. But I had a plan, which was that first I should be a farmer, and then at least I wouldn't be a starving artist.
Since the seeds they grow are genetic packages, maybe it's not surprising a battle erupted when some of these farmers, including Tim Wynn, started growing genetically engineered sugar beets. Organic farmer Frank Morton is on one side of the battle.
So I'm on record as saying that the valley is not big enough to have genetically engineered crops and normal crops growing together without inevitably cross-contamination happening.
But Tim Wynn says there's nothing new or risky that Frank Morton or his customers should worry about.
We can invent a perceived risk in our mind. A lot of us do. And if science doesn't support it, then it's not a risk. If his customers are concerned about it, then I guess if he wants to stay in business with those customers, it would be in his interest to educate them.
This standoff is more than just a local dispute. It's raising the question of whether genetically engineered crops and organic farms can be good neighbors in the Willamette Valley or anywhere. The best place to start to understand this controversy is probably the farm where Frank Morton grows his organic seeds, Gathering Together Farm.
Cabbage, arugula, Swiss chard, turnips.
We pass one field after another.
This is about a quarter acre of chard seed here, or it will be for chard seed. Would you like to get out?
Sure.
Morton brought me here to explain how producing seed is different from growing regular crops. You have to watch out for stray pollen. This golden chard, he explained, is actually the same species as beets. They're all Beta vulgaris, the way black Labradors and golden retrievers are all dogs. Those different plants will cross-pollinate. So if you want to produce high-quality chard seed, you do not want beet pollen blowing into your field. And pollen can blow for miles. As it happens, Morton says, there's a sugar beet seed grower straight across the fields a couple of miles away.
Apparently they're not finding my red chard or gold chard seed in their sugar beets, and I haven't found any of their genetics in mine that I know of. There's always some question, and that's the problem, is there's always some question.
Now, the local Seed Growers Association has a system for avoiding cross-pollination. The approach is charmingly low-tech, just a map of the valley with a lot of pins stuck in it to show where each seed crop is planted. For farmers, it's first come, first served. If you pin a sugar beet field, nobody else is supposed to grow seed for Swiss chard within 3 miles.
Here's a sugar beet field that's pinned. There's another one that's pinned.
George Burt helped set up this pinning system when he was manager of the West Coast Beet Seed Company. He's now retired.
You're really trying to minimize the risk, and you can get it down to the point where you're relatively sure that you're not hurting anybody else and no one's hurting you.
But you cannot promise that absolutely no cross-fertilization will happen, ever, he says. For organic grower Frank Morton, that system was fine until farmers in the valley started growing sugar beets that were genetically engineered to tolerate the weed killer Roundup. He wants absolute protection against those man-made genes. If they got into his chard or red beets, he says, it would violate his organic principles and it would destroy his business because his customers wouldn't buy his seeds anymore. In fact, he says, just the possibility of contamination is starting to hurt.
We think that buyers from overseas, organic seed companies, we think they have already begun to avoid buying from us.
So Morton, together with some environmental groups, went to court, and he won. A federal judge banned the planting of Roundup Ready sugar beets until the USDA does an environmental impact study that examines the economic consequences of cross-pollination, especially for organic farmers. In a similar case, another judge demanded the same thing for genetically engineered alfalfa. Listening to these farmers, there does not seem to be an easy solution. Organic grower Frank Morton says his business cannot survive if there are genetically engineered crops, often called GMOs, anywhere nearby.
It'll be a valley fit for growing GMOs, but it won't be a valley where people from Europe and Japan and Korea come to have seed grown.
And Tim Wynn says Frank Morton's demands and his lawsuit could cripple a crucial industry.
Because quite honestly, if you regulate this valley to the point where you don't have, you know, sugar beet seed production or the production of some other major commodities, that's a huge deal.
there's one voice calling for compromise. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack released an open letter last month proposing what he called a new paradigm of coexistence and cooperation. Giving in a little, Vilsack said, would be better than litigation that puts one side or the other one out of business. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Finally, we bring you a conversation about a new answer to one of history's classic questions.
I think what we're going to find is that there are different systems at play. And so with the dopamine gene that we found that we share in common with our friends, there's a very intuitive explanation there because it's related to this behavior that's a very social behavior. But for the opposite attract genes, we might find things like genes that are related to the immune system. It's been known for some time that people tend to choose spouses who have different immune systems because you don't want to be exposed to a disease that you're susceptible to. You spend a lot of time with your spouse, and so if they get it, then you're definitely going to get it. You want them to be able to fight off all those diseases that you can't fight off. We expect that we might find this in friends as well because we spend a lot of time with our friends.
This gene that you found is also the same gene that is associated with alcoholism. So how does that translate into picking friends?
Well, it's interesting. The genes that we would tend to find that are similar to us could have gotten similar in two different ways. One is that you actively choose friends who are like you in a way that's related to the gene. So if the gene is associated with drinking behavior, you might be slightly more likely to drink, and you might choose friends who like to drink
that
because that's an activity.
Right. That seems intuitive.
That's right. Another possibility is that maybe you're not choosing friends actively at all who are like you, but you're drawn to similar environments. Mm. And so if you have a version of this gene, you might be more likely to end up in a bar where other people who have a version of the gene are also more likely to end up, and you might just happen to make friends with people who are near you.
I guess this sort of gives new meaning to this notion of a drinking buddy.
Yes, and you know, there are some larger points from the study here. I think people, they're very focused on, you know, which gene is it and what does this gene do? But there's a larger point here, which is that we might find ourselves not only biologically susceptible to a particular behavior, but if we are similar to our friends biologically, then we're also surrounded by other people who are susceptible. And what you get in these networks is you get these patchworks of localized susceptibility that are created by our genes and the genes of those around us.
But couldn't this be a problem if people who are alcoholics, for example, are attracted to other alcoholics? I mean, doesn't this actually make the situation worse?
Absolutely. And this is a point that we make. There can be feedback effects that we never thought of before when we were just looking at your genes and your behavior. Our genes not only influence us, but they may influence the genes of our friends, which in turn has an additional effect on us. So, for example, the DRD2 gene variant that we study in this particular research has been associated with alcoholism. And if you have this gene variant, your friends are likely to have it too. So you're not only more susceptible to alcoholism, but you're likely to be surrounded by friends who are susceptible as well.
Do you use Facebook, Dr. Fowler?
I do, absolutely.
And so do your genes affect who you friend on Facebook, or is that different?
I wouldn't say that you are genetically similar to all of the hundreds of friends that you might find yourself surrounded by. But certainly among that group of people, the real friends, the people that you see every day in real life, I would expect there to be some similarity at the genetic level.
That's James Fowler. He's a professor of medical genetics and political science at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of Connected: How Your Friends, Friends, Friends Affect Everything You Feel, Think, and Do. James Fowler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the Oregon Trail, not the historic path of Western expansion, but perhaps the most popular educational computer game of all time. Ah, yes, fording the river, changing a broken wagon wheel, dying of dysentery. Happy memories for millions of school children who, since 1971, have spent hours pretending to set off on that 2,000-mile-long journey in the year 1848.
Well, are you ready? Come on, let's go!
The game is now on the iPhone, and next week another version is set to launch on Facebook. Now, the story of how Oregon Trail was created begins in 1971. Don Rarich was teaching junior high in Minneapolis, and he was having trouble getting his students interested in...
That's all for the podcast this week. Remember, you can let us know what you'd like to hear by emailing sciencepodcast@npr.org. I'm Andrew Prince.